It's complicated. A few simple words that convey a lot, especially with subjects like federal farm policy, which has a substantial impact on growers and also becomes more complex every year. For example, the last farm bill, the summary alone, was 122 pages. Fortunately, there are experts to help us navigate through this dynamic landscape.
Agriculture is rebranding right now to be a participant at that sustainability table. They've learned some lessons. I think it's a good sign. But agriculture wants farmer sustainability. That's called income sustainability. And I think there's enough to go around.
We'll speak with one of the best in this area, Jim Wiesmeyer, next. Welcome to Redox Grows, an in-depth look at key issues affecting agriculture and the people that make it all happen. I'm Jim Morris with Redox Bionutrients in Burley, Idaho. Many years ago, I first heard our next guest speak, and I was very impressed with Jim Wiesmeyer's understanding of ag issues from Washington, D.C., and equally impressed with how he conveyed it to an audience in an easy-to-understand way. That is not an easy trick. He is still knocking it out of the park today, very active decades into his job, and he joins us now remotely. Good to visit with you, Jim.
Good to be with you. I always say now, all great men are dead, and I'm not well myself.
Jim is a graduate of Southern Illinois University, so that'll make him a Saluki. He has been covering farm, economic, energy, and trade policy development since 1978 from his office near Washington, D.C. He reported on and regularly interviews the top echelon of policymakers. That long list includes Presidents Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, as well as Agriculture Secretary since Earl Butts. He is Washington Policy Analyst for Pro Farmer and Farm Journal Media. U.S. farm income, Jim, is projected at an 18-year low. What are the factors for this decline, and how worrisome is it?
I think it is worrisome. Now we're not back to the 1980s when it was a depression to me in agriculture, although USDA's current forecast of net farm income and cash income this year versus 2023 is down $40 billion. And that's on top of the downturn the previous year of $26 billion. And that's a hit. It's primarily, I think, as a result, of course, of lower prices. And the input cost, while they've come down, fertilizer, et cetera, they've not come down nearly as much as prices have on a percentage basis. So, yeah, it's a hit. And I particularly watch corn because of the 87 to 90 million acres planted. It can make a big difference on the price of corn relative to farm income.
How is the corn market going, and what do you foresee there?
Well, so far, okay. I think the market is in the time frame prior to planting where we're looking at acreage, and we're going to get a prospective plantings report out on the 28th, and we'll see. It looks like our Pro Farmer survey showed a clear tilt toward soybeans versus corn. If that's the case, and if it's close to our number, you could see a mini rally for corn after that prospective plantings report, because the markets are going to bid for acres. But history tells me that one in this type of price environment, one should sell rallies, because it's not too bad as long in the about 18 months you have to market a crop. As long as you have an opportunity to make a profit. The hardest years are those in which you don't ever have a month at which you can make a profit. So we've been there before. I think we'll have some profitable months to market. So what I just said is you can't go bankrupt making money. A farmer knows his cost and price structure. Be aware.
So let's talk about the farm bill. Every time I have a slight delay on a project, it makes me feel better to think about the procrastination on the farm bill. It was originally expected to be passed last year. It was extended. What's going on there, Jim, and what are the odds of it passing this year?
This is why I never put a year on a farm bill. I just say the new farm bill. Okay. We've had 19 farm bills in the history of our great country. I will have covered 11 of them. I've learned a lot, but each one is different. This one is, it looks like recently we've gone backwards rather than forwards recently, because the same issues are there. It's the funding issue. We need billions more dollars to improve the Title I, that's the safety net portion of the farm bill, and in particular, reference prices. All the major farm program crops know that, even rice, peanuts, cotton, corn, soybeans. You need a higher reference price to deal with the cost price structure. The problem is that the baseline, the Farm Bill baseline, doesn't allow for the money needed to really improve those reference prices. Here's how I will answer your question. Most of the veterans in Washington looking at the Farm Bill, they almost think to the person that you're not going to get a bill this year. I never kill something until it's dead. Once lawmakers come back from their Easter recess in early April 8th and 9th, you know, depending on the House and the Senate, between that date and, let's say, Memorial Day, the House Ag Committee, chaired by G.T. Thompson, Republican from Pennsylvania, they're going to release what we call the chairman's mark. That'll be the farm bill proposal. Now, we're going to have to see the details on that, because the speculation, our sources are saying, it will likely include $40 to $50 billion in additional funding for reference price increases. Now, if that's the case, that'll be interesting. And I think that that'll get some, at least Republicans on the Senate Ag Committee, to go along with that. But how are they going to pay for that? That's going to be a potential albatross, because if they get into restructuring the food stamp program in any way, and if they move around conservation program funding, because conservation got $20 billion additional dollars from the Inflation Reduction Act, which is law now. I really call it the climate bill. And Stabenow, who's Senate Ag Committee chairwoman, has said, you're not going to rob one title to pay for another. So that's why people, at least in this town, are lower odds that you're going to have a bill this year. But I think one is needed, because how's it going to improve in 2025? When we're going to have even a higher debt, our debt increases $1 trillion every 100 days. So after elections, I think both political parties, but especially Republicans, are going to go back to worrying about deficits and debt. We're going to know, I think, by Memorial Day, whether or not where the odds are on a farm bill this calendar year. One is needed because we need the higher reference prices. One is needed because we need continued improvements in crop insurance. And the speculation is that this bill, at least the House side, is going to include some reforms in crop insurance, positive reforms, maybe higher for more incentives to buy up, higher coverage, and perhaps some funding to improve the what we call the area-wide programs, the ECO and SCO.
I'm glad you mentioned crop insurance. You've stated that it's the best risk management tool that you've seen in your time in D.C. Why is it so valuable, and who benefits from it?
To me, it's the best approach that I've ever seen between private industry with the private crop insurance agents, the people who support crop insurance agencies, and the government, USDA, with risk management agency. And that's really been since, really when you look at the program, since 2000. It was called the ARPA Act. And it has continuously improved. Here's the best thing I can say about crop insurance, and not just crops, so livestock now, because the dramatic growth we've seen in the last few years under dairy and cattle has just been phenomenal. But crop insurance equals food security. because had we had the current risk management tools embodied in crop insurance that we have now in the 1980s, when we had that dramatic downturn in prices, it would have helped. Now, not everything, but it would have helped because of revenue assurance programs embodied in the crop insurance. So that's what I say. And if they continually improve it, I mentioned the area-wide programs. Right now, it paid off last year, which I call ECO and SCO. If the Farm Bill increases the incentives to make that that program option more viable to purchase, when you think about it, that lessens the need for ad hoc disaster programs, because ECO is really shallow loss farming. It goes up to, I think, 96% of coverage. So that's why I'm really watching what they do relative to crop insurance. Bottom line, though, best risk management tool from a production, but mainly from a revenue assurance type of a program. And you're not going to get that. That's why you need crop insurance, because Title I, the Farm Program Safety Net, reference prices, et cetera, won't account for consecutive years of really low prices. That's why you have the revenue assurance programs and crop insurance. So that's kind of where I say it just works. It just works. And Washington has a habit of fooling around with things that work from a negative perspective. I'm fascinated by that. But I would say mostly leave it alone.
Now we're going to turn to what for many is America's new spectator sport. I preferred when it was baseball or the NFL, but the presidential race does get a lot of attention these days. And there's a lot at stake, I believe, for agriculture. So what are your thoughts on the impact to agriculture and to growers, depending on who prevails in the race come November 5th, as well as the House and Senate?
Yeah, White House, House, and Senate. In my speeches, I say I'm an equal opportunity finger pointer for both political parties, because I think so many Americans want different choices than what they've been given, at least at the White House level. That's blunt. It does depend who leads our country. Now, if either political party wins at all by the gamut, the triad, the White House, House, and Senate, that's where you get your most significant impacts. That's how former President Trump got his tax cuts in 2017. And that's how our current president, Joe Biden, got his climate change and big spending bills through when the Democrats controlled everything. So that's what you got to watch out for. Now, generally, a Republican thrust leads to less regulations. It's just history shows that. When Democrats are in control, you have more regulations. Not that all regulations are bad, but in the case of agriculture, it gets into unfunded mandates. To me, regulations are taxes on small business, so you want to limit them. So that's one area. When you have a Democrat-controlled Washington in a major way, they'll usually favor two types of programs, food stamps, food and nutrition programs. I mean, that's an easy conclusion, and also child care tax incentives. Now, both of those go onto the input that you use more of crops for food. So I can talk both sides. In the case of Republicans, I mentioned before, they will tend to lower taxes. You saw it with Trump in 2017, and I'll guarantee you lower taxes if Trump and gets in and the House and Senate are Republican controlled. You'll have further tax reductions. If the Democrats control everything at a certain level, 400,000 or above in revenue, your taxes are going to go up.
A next step following that as well, it would be following the cabinet appointee situation. And how important is that for agriculture to keep an eye on?
Cabinet members are very important if the president listens to them. I remember Earl Butz saying he heard of the embargoes on the radio, you know. So I'm not saying they didn't listen to Mr. Butz, but not all the time. Jimmy Carter didn't listen to his ag secretary, and he didn't listen to his vice president at the time that he had the embargo on the then Soviet Union. Had he listened to both the USDA and the vice president at the time, he wouldn't have done that. And he listened to the CIA. So in the case of the current side, Tom Vilsack is the ag secretary and has been under the Obama administration and now into the full-fledged Biden administration. And he's a very knowledgeable guy. He is just focused more on not production agriculture, but on more equity issues. Biden really listens to him, especially in the case of climate change in the area that we're very much getting into. I think one of the key components in the years and decades ahead will be energy-related programs relative to the agribusiness sector. I think it's going to be important on the cabinet, secretary, no matter who wins. And that goes with the vice president. If Trump were to get in, then if Kristi Noem is the vice president, she's the current governor of South Dakota, that's a pretty positive sign for agriculture because she came up from a cattle farm, raised on a cattle farm. And to me, if you're understandable on cattle, you know feed. And that gets you into a lot of program crops. So to answer your question, it depends on the president and how secure they are, because I've seen different presidents. Reagan really counted on his secretary, and at the time it was Dick Ling in his administration. They mostly listened to their agricultural secretaries, and that's a good thing, because in the realm of agriculture, a lot of things can happen, and a good ag secretary can ask two things: keep a president out of trouble in ag policy, and two, be a spokesperson for the agriculture sector, cheerleader, if you will, because we need all the help we can get.
Educating the consumer is and always will be critical. And I want to ask you about exports. That's obviously another very important part of the agricultural industry. So how do you compare and contrast the likely Democrat and Republican trade agendas?
It's so similar right now. And I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. We have turned protectionist in trade policy. Trump was very aggressive against China. It was a trade war. There's no other way to say it. And Biden really hasn't changed that. You have our current U.S. trade rep is Katherine Tai. Again, smart lady, but she tells agriculture groups that the reason why they're not focusing on new either bilateral or multilateral trade agreements is they've taken a different approach because while they have helped agriculture over the decades, it hasn't helped all that many other sectors, i.e. manufacturing. So they're not focusing on agriculture right now. And I think that's a detriment. And look at the agricultural trade numbers. We used to have every year an agricultural trade surplus. The current year, we have a forecast of a deficit, ag deficit of $30.5 billion. Now, Vilsack, as USDA Secretary at a recent Ag Appropriation Subcommittee hearing, said, when you dig into the numbers, it's the result of a high U.S. dollar and greater than expected imports in the sugar and in the horticultural area. I don't think that explains it all. I think it's policy because Brazil is eating our cake and having it too. They're now the largest exporter of soybeans, corn, and now cotton. There's a reason for that.
You've been to China twice, and China comes up in the news cycle and agricultural stories, and it will be for a long time, I suspect. What are your impressions about China in general and also its agricultural capabilities?
Its agricultural capabilities on the one side are limited because of the arable land. However, they're just putting their thrust now in GMOs. So I think the next decade, you're going to see an increase in their yields because we've got data to prove that. Once you get those traits involved, they fought them for years, but now they want to increase their own production. And the reason is that from a geopolitical basis, they have their designs on Taiwan in the future, and their just attitudes toward the world is different. So we're no longer going to be able to rely on China as a key component of our export thrust, and especially in the case of soybeans, to a degree corn, not as much, sorghum, but especially in the meat area. What I'm beginning to sense is while the two countries will continue to trade with each other, I think you're going to see a different shift in trade patterns. Less U.S. trade to China, but we're going to displace some of the other countries that China usually bought from and plow our exports into those nations. So you're just going to see a restructuring of trade. But that's part of the downturn, to connect dots from your other question. Our exports are off in a number of commodities. And that again, brings in the thing of trade policy, our geopolitical issues with the number of countries and things like that. So, but I don't see that changing short term because there's not much difference between Trump and Biden when it comes to trade policy. I think they're insular, which again, to connect dots, that's why some in agriculture are focusing on domestic utilization, which brings up the dramatic importance of sustainable aviation fuel, SAF, and other biofuels, because it looks like we're moving a little more towards, but not totally, domestic consumption of agriculture.
That latter category you mentioned, that would be for soybeans and perhaps corn?
Let's hope for corn, because you're not going to reach the gallons that you need for the airline sector for sustainable aviation fuel without corn-based ethanol being qualified for those tax incentives. Eventually, we're going to hear the official announcements from both the Treasury Department, because it's a tax incentive. That's why we're waiting on the Treasury Department. And the important side, it's a combination of EPA, Energy Department, and USDA, relative to what's called the GREET model, G-R-E-E-T. And that's what they're going to use in part to ascertain how different U.S. Producers, soybeans, and hopefully corn, qualify for some of these tax and incentives. And I think it's extremely important. They were supposed to announce the details by March 1, but at the Commodity Classic in Houston, we had a problem. They didn't announce it, I think because it was going to be negative news for the corn producers. So I think they're regrouping right now. Vilsack has said it would be weeks and not months, so the clock is ticking, okay? But I'll tell you, I think we're going to see a potential mega change in agriculture if this carbon intensity, that's your two key words, carbon intensity, and that's good for everybody. And because farmers are going to have to know their carbon intensity score. And this GREET model will have different consultants are going to hopefully help farmers decide what are they doing, what do they need to do to improve their carbon intensity score, because that's what you're going to be paid on relative to the billions of dollars that's going to be paid out in the future. Now, in the case of corn, you have ethanol plants. They're also going to qualify. And so I see that as building for the future of this program. And I think eventually corn will qualify. But I'll tell you, if there's one mega change to watch out, it's this. And why do I call it a mega change? In the case of soybeans, we're going to crush more for oil in the future, soybean oil, rather than meal. And that's a fundamental change. 50% of the soybeans crushed in the year ending last September was for oil. And that's a change from decades. That's going to mean there's a livestock and poultry angle to this. That's going to mean a lot more meal. So that's going to lower, at least temper, feed cost for the livestock sector ahead, because we're going to have a lot of meal floating around. But it also means we're going to have to export some meal too, which again raises the importance of trade policy. We're going to have to get rid of the stuff, in other words.
One of the other big areas that people are talking about, whenever I visit with growers, labor invariably comes up. Worker availability, cost, regulations, you name it. What are the chances for any help from Washington in this area?
Oh, I wish I could say yes. But it's because we need immigration reform. We need guest worker reform. It's coming, but not in this political environment where everything, especially in this issue with labor, it gets into immigration issues. It's just too uncivil between the political parties. There was a Washington Post story earlier this week, a dramatic story. Mexico, in the next few years, is going to have a hard time finding enough people for their agriculture sector. Can you believe that? That tells you, because more and more are coming over here. So they're having programs to incentivize more Mexican workers to stay in Mexico. But you're right, Jim. One of the biggest questions I get from larger producers, and definitely CEOs of agribusiness companies, is on workers. How do you get them? How do you keep them? And what about the H-2A program that needs reformed? Eventually, you're going to have an immigration reform bill that will have an ag package embodied in it, more H-2A workers, et cetera, but not anytime soon, because it's such a divisive issue. It gets into border security, and you know, all you have to do is turn on the television and you see 180 degree differences between the political parties on border security and how to deal with it. But it is a factor, the cost side too. In order to deal with some of the regulations, and we're connecting dots here. We've forced certain regulations on some of the incoming workers outside of this country, where they have to have a certain pay, facilities, et cetera, that raises the cost. And so there's the dilemma going on, and you're seeing it across the U.S. And I don't think the issue has been given the breadth that I hear in agriculture wherever I go.
Sustainability is another topic I want to ask you about. You mentioned conservation earlier. You know, farmers naturally care for the land. They want to continue to go for generations to come. But how is sustainability viewed nationally in your estimation? And what momentum do you see in this area?
Agriculture is rebranding right now to be a participant at that sustainability table. They've learned some lessons. I think it's a good sign. But agriculture wants farmer sustainability. That's called income sustainability. And I think there's enough to go around. You have very public conscience food companies, chemical companies, et cetera, who want to be sustainable practices. Agriculture now, it could be a positive element sitting at that table. For some of the reasons I said, production practices, biofuel incentives, et cetera. So I think we're there. I think it's a term that should no longer be feared. As long as agriculture is going to have to be a big participant to make it work. So embody it. Because when the Secretary Vilsack at USDA tells farmers, this area, and sustainability and biofuels and climate smart practices is this term, could be the next big revenue stream for agriculture. Well, farmers have Dumbo ears when they hear that. Now they want to see proof. and they want to see how the sustainable aviation fuel incentives are going to be, who qualifies, et cetera. So to answer bluntly, to answer your question, sustainability is here to stay, and agriculture must be a participant in it.
And I imagine you, as well as growers, favor incentivizing this area and not penalizing?
I like the carrot before the stick. Okay. Regretfully, some people in this town want to go about it the other way. They'll stick you first. And that's not the way to do it. You're seeing it in electric vehicles, where the current administration and, frankly, Democrats in Congress want to mandate the purchase and utilization of electric vehicles, where a more market-oriented person will say, let the market decide. Now, you can help an industry, much like ethanol was helped out in the early days and still is relative to the Renewable Fuel Standard program. And ethanol got better and better. Now, 60% or more reduction in the use of water in the production of ethanol. It used to be DDGs was a throwaway offset in the early days of ethanol. I remember it when it was gasohol. And now it's a viable alternative to protein for feed purposes. The market isn't perfect. Sometimes you do need assistance. Agriculture knows that. Agriculture needs help in a dramatic weather environment. They need help. And two, agriculture needs help from a market development perspective for trade, with the MAP program, with FMD, and that's going to be in the House Farm Bill, by the way, too, a pretty good increase in trade promotion programs. So that's all embodied in the to make a sector whole.
You are such a fount of information. You've been at this for 53 years. You do 40-plus speaking engagements a year and are a regular media presence. And I've been to events in places like San Diego and New Orleans where people could be outside enjoying these resort areas, and you pack the house. So what do you enjoy about your job, Jim?
I'm still passionate for it because, you know, agriculture is an area. I was a history major, actually, in college. And agriculture, had to keep up with it, you have to be knowledgeable on the things that we've discussed already. Think about it. Look at that. Tax policy, crop insurance, energy policy, geopolitics, the economy. And I love all those topics. And I've not seen an industry that weaves all that through. When I'm having dinner several times with my urban friends, they frequently ask me, what do you have to cover? And I say all these topics and they go, you know, a farmer nowadays has to be pretty smart to just be in the sector. I said, you think so? Yes, absolutely. So that's and I was raised by parents that were superb. They taught us to question things, but to read and be inquisitive on topics. And I haven't lost that. And in agriculture now, it's the networking, as I know you know. When you go out to these meetings, I learn hopefully as much as I depart. But I also pick up from farmers who are so good at knowing how to live. They're family-oriented people, which I am. They're production agriculture, and how do you go away from that? I just love it. I just love when I see their productive might, how challengers of change they are, how they're on the cutting edge of all this technology we're talking about. 90% of the use of all drones in business are in agriculture, because farmers are challengers of change. They have to be in order to get technology to work for them rather than against them to be price competitive. So to me, that still excites me.
Well, and they are better off with the insight that you provide, Jim. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Anytime.
That will wrap up this episode. You can follow Jim's excellent reporting at profarmer.com. Or, as many in ag know, he just might be speaking at your next conference. If you head to redoxgrows.com, you'll find a new series as we discuss the science behind our products. Plus, you'll find every podcast episode, product information, both conventional and organic, for agriculture and turf, and so much more. If you have comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at podcast@redoxgrows.com. Thanks for listening.